We Made This. Welcome back, everybody, to the Movie Palace. I'm your host, as ever, Carl Sweeney, and thank you very much for joining me again for this week's episode, which is all about The Public Enemy, the great gangster film from 1931, directed by William A. Wellman, Wild Bill Wellman, I think it was called, the Warner Brothers film starring James Cagney. And I'm delighted to be joined once again by Andy Wolverton. Hey, Andy.
Hey, Carl. How are you?
Yeah, I'm okay, thank you. Yeah, nice. Nice to talk to you again. It's been a while. I think Detour was the last episode we spoke on.
Yeah, that was fun. That has been a while. So, yeah, thanks for having me back.
Yeah, and obviously that was at a very carefree time, and it's not that anymore. I mean, it's not my courtesy to say, like, how are you on the podcast in an introduction, but yeah, how have things been with you and, you know, during the whole pandemic and so on?
Actually, things could have been a lot worse for us personally. I haven't started back to work yet, but, I'm still getting paid. I'm doing a lot of work from home, library programs. In fact, I'm running a virtual library movie discussion group every Friday night. Yeah. And, that's kept me busy and some other library work. So we're very fortunate. You know, things are mainly just inconvenient, which, you know, again, we're very fortunate that things aren't worse. How about you guys?
Yeah, it's been okay. I mean, I've been working from home. It's inconvenience in the sense that the kids are at home and it's not the same. And, you know, it's tough, but like you say, it could have been a lot worse. And I feel quite fortunate, honestly. Yeah. I mean, how have the library discussions gone then? Because like you were doing those in person, of course, and now you're doing them remotely. So, yeah, what kind of differences has that – what kind of difficulties has it posed you?
You know, I was a little worried about how it would go because normally we would show a movie and then talk about it afterward. But the downside of that is we normally only had about maybe 20 minutes to discuss movies. And now we watch them in advance. They're all on a streaming service called Canopy. I don't know if you have that in the U.K. So they watch the movie beforehand and we get together and discuss the movie online and we can talk for over an hour. So that's been great. You know, we can go into more detail. We can get more, just talk more about the film itself, break it down if we want to. But it's really been a wonderful experience. I'm really looking forward to continuing it, which we'll be doing for a while.
Yeah.
And I was going to tell your listeners, if anybody wants to get in on it, they can contact me. We've had, although I'm stationed in Maryland, we've had listeners in Chicago. We've had a guy from Canada that joins us each time. So everyone's welcome.
Yeah, that's nice. I think I feel like I should join in too. But I think it's just so far it's been the time zone thing. I'm normally in bed by the time it starts, but I could, I suppose I could be a bit less boring. I could stay up late and join in the future. I'll have to try.
We'd love to have you.
I think it'd be a lot of fun. Yeah. I'll do my best. I promise.
Okay.
Yeah. So I might ask you again about that at the end. Like, be interesting to hear what's coming up, but yeah, let's turn to, well, we're going to talk about The Public Enemy, but just in general, I thought this would be an interesting one to cover because, I don't believe we've covered a gangster film on the podcast before, and I really like gangster films. So we're actually doing a few in the next, in the coming weeks. So after The Public Enemy, I'll be doing an episode on Bonnie and Clyde, which is a crossover with my friend Tony Black and his new podcast, The New Wave. Because obviously Bonnie and Clyde's maybe a little outside of the time span that we cover on this podcast usually, but it's a fun one to do. And then Independence Day, we'll be doing White Heat in a crossover with the 250 podcast. So yeah, some good episodes coming up, hopefully.
Very nice.
Are you a gangster fan generally, Andy, before we come on to The Public Enemy specifically? You like this kind of film?
I do. Initially, I'd watched a lot of gangster films just to see like some of the origins of film noir, which I really, really love. And I've noticed some of that, but it's, you know, the gangster film is fascinating in its own right, which I'm sure we will get into, but, it really is its own thing. And, you know, you can say it's still going on. And like you said, Bonnie and Clyde is kind of outside the classic, you know, purview of your podcast. But, mm-hmm. you know, it's clearly it's still going on. There are still gangster movies being made.
Yeah, totally. And which is fascinating because we'll talk about how they were so kind of rooted in like things like Prohibition, which are now like, you know, way, way, way in the past. but yeah, no, I mean, the Public Enemy then. So I don't know. I mean, how widely seen do you think this film is? Like, I'm not sure how we've done films recently, for instance, like Some Like It Hot and Rear Window, where I know there's a broad recognition of those films amongst even general audiences. I'm not as sure if that's the case with The Public Enemy. I mean, what's your sense on that?
You don't hear it talked about a lot. At least I don't hear it talked about a lot, except when people do specifically talk about classic gangster films. They typically will talk about this, Little Caesar, yeah. and Scarface. You know, those are the three that you typically hear. And then things kind of evolve beyond that. But I don't think people talk about gangster films as much as they talk about film noir, because, you know, that in the last few years has really exploded. But it would be great for people to discover or rediscover some of the great films in the gangster genre. It really should be talked about for many reasons that we'll touch on, I'm sure, especially Cagney.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, yeah, that's what I want to do is talk about this film and kind of set it in its historical context as well, just to kind of paint a picture for people. So I think before we come to like our thoughts on the film, The Public Enemy, I mean, what are the basics people need to know if they're unfamiliar with it? People might be listening to the podcast and haven't seen it or might check it out later. How would you kind of paint a picture of The Public Enemy for people?
Well, Carl, you were very correct in pointing out the Prohibition era, and you know that was so long ago that a lot of people either, you know, don't remember it if they're still alive, or they don't really know much about what it was like. The Ken Burns documentary, I think, goes a long way in helping people understand that. But I think what people basically need to understand was, you know, the Roaring Twenties had ended. And the Great Depression had set in, and as far as films were going, the talkies were firmly in place by this time. And even this early on, Warner Brothers was really the studio that was interested in really gritty stories from the city, stories of working class people. And Jack Warner realized that taking stories from the headlines would sell movies just as well as they sold newspapers. And I think one of the things that we tend to forget, too, is these were national stories that he was pulling. So usually anybody, no matter where they live, they had read about these stories and these situations. The names were changed for the movies, but the audiences, they knew exactly whose stories they were watching. And they knew that the gangster activity represented, as we talked about before, a definite anti-prohibition stance. But during the Depression, the gangster was seen by a lot of people as a threat to American values. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there was something just compelling about gangsters. And I did a little research and found that in a Chicago poll from 1931, the best known personalities in America were Hollywood movie stars and Chicago mobsters. So, yeah. And this, I think, is something that will come up later in our discussion, too. To some people looking away for a way out of the Depression, the gangster life actually looked pretty good. I mean, people were saying, you know, that's really a way to get ahead and advance economically. But going back to the you know, brief history of gangster films, they've been around for a long time. Yeah. I think the first one I know about is from 1912, called The Musketeers of Pig Alley. But, you know, they really, really hit their stride with Little Caesar in early 1931. And then Public Enemy came just a few months after that. And then Scarface the next year. So you had like three mega gangster movies in a row. And that really just lit the place on fire.
Yeah, like you say, and I think some of these things we can tease out a bit more, but just the idea that the gangster appealed at this time of broader hardship is a fascinating one. As regards The Public Enemy, so this film, as I said, with James Cagney, was nominated for one Academy Award, Best Writing Original Story for John Bright and Kubek Glasman. And the film, in 1998, was selected for preservation in the United States National Film Registry by the Library of Congress for its, you know, for its significance. And I think it is a significant film for historical reasons that you've started to outline there and that we'll talk about more. But I think it holds up really well. I think it's a very nicely paced film. I think, and you mentioned there how it's often grouped alongside films like Little Caesar as significant gangster films of this time. Personally, this is the one I would recommend people check out first of that group, because I think, mainly because Cagney, I think, is a very contemporary presence, and I think will appeal to a lot of people. And because I think this film in general is just very fluid, much more so than Little Caesar, for instance, which is, like I say, it's an important film. It's a little bit more static, I think. What do you reckon, Andy? Is this a film you would recommend people watch for its entertainment value, even setting aside its kind of historical significance?
I do think it is, and I think you're right, Carl, that of the three films, Little Caesar, Public Enemy, and Scarface, this is probably the one to start with. And the reason, I think, is because although Little Caesar is a great film, there's a lot of things that it doesn't do that the Public Enemy does. For instance, Little Caesar does not really give us much about Rico, played by Edward G. Robinson. We don't get much about Rico's background,
yeah.
Which we do get with the Public Enemy. We don't really see him committing his crimes that much. Most of that is off screen. The Public Enemy also allows us to see Tom as more of a character. We see him in his youth. We see what influenced him, what led him to a life of crime. Little Caesar doesn't go there. And we also have this great tension in, that you'll see in a lot of the gangster films, between the gangster's actual family and his gangster family. And so those are some of the things that set the Public Enemy off from Little Caesar. It's just such a, some of those gangster tropes are really, really starting to take hold with the Public Enemy.
Yeah, and it's interesting though, isn't it? Like, they don't necessarily foreground all of those things in the way that, you know, when you look at films like The Godfather, for instance, and issues of family, it's a bit more matter of fact, I suppose. But yeah, so that's a good point. And what do you make of the style of this film then? Because it's quite a straightforward, no-frills film in a lot of ways, isn't it? And I think that's in keeping with some of those counterparts, you know, the Little Caesars and Scarfaces. I guess because they're kind of striving for realism, you know, and as you say, these films are responding to contemporary news stories. And that seems to kind of dictate the visual style, doesn't it? Like, I didn't really notice any particularly distracting filmmaking techniques or anything. I don't know about you.
No, I think one of the things that the film does really well is you see, we have kind of this little parade through history at the beginning of the film, starting in 1909. So that gives audiences a bit of a historical foundation for the rise of crime in the 20s and 30s. And some of those audience members would have remembered those times. I mean, this came out in 1931. So you're talking about, you know, 20, 21, 22 mm-hmm. years ago. Yeah. Audiences were familiar with that. And, you know, it's almost like it's got kind of a semi-documentary feel at the beginning. And that would come to be very prevalent in later film noir. So I do think that the film is the historical stuff that opens the film is very, very I'm not sure how much of that was done before that. My knowledge of, you know, pre-30s movies is pretty slim. But, you know, that was kind of a little encapsulation of here's how we got here.
Yeah, and I think that as well as the filmmaking being quite straightforward, and I think, like you say, Wellman, in doing those sort of scenes, those early 1909 scenes, he seems to have quite a nice feel for kind of the street life and stuff like that. But yeah, it's a narrative that moves, you know, in a linear fashion, which is interesting because you say that gangster films are often conflated with film noir or kind of just often referred to as a predecessor and so on, these early films. But they're very different, aren't they? Because we think of film noir, we think of the flashbacks and tricky narrative structures and things. You don't get any of that in a film like The Public Enemy necessarily, apart from these time jumps. So yeah, it's interesting how The Public Enemy sets about that, isn't it, with like those scenes with the kids. And I don't know if you've heard the story about the casting of the kids and how something changed during production. Do you know what I'm talking about there?
I do, yeah. I know where you're going with that, yeah.
Go on, you can tell us then, Andy. What have you heard?
Well, there's been, and you know, I've dug around a little bit, and I haven't been able to find anything definite about this, but apparently James Cagney, who was playing Tom, was originally supposed to play Matt, which Edward Woods played. Now, Cagney says that it was, you know, they never shot 1 second of film with him being Matt, that he was always supposed to be Tom. But as you can see in the scenes with the kids, one of the commentators I listened to said that they filmed the kids as the kids were supposed to switch roles like the adults were, that, you know, the really tall kid is Cagney, which makes no sense at all. And then the shorter kid that looks like Edward Woods is playing the other role. So, you know, I don't really know if, I'm not sure. I'll be interested to hear what you ran across, but, it does seem very striking once you see these kids for several minutes and then we see them as adults and, it's not what you would think.
Yeah, although, I mean, that's exactly what I heard, basically. And I never noticed that the first time I watched the film, though. But I can see it going back to it. I think that maybe because Cagney was not as much of an established presence, of course, at this point, but the kid who's supposed to look like Cagney, he's not exactly a dead ringer for him. There's a physical kind of resemblance, but it's not like, you know, I think that in later years they might have cast somebody with a more distinct resemblance. So, yeah, it never bothered me, and it's never something I noticed. It's not something I noticed on first viewing, certainly. But it's an interesting little bit of trivia, isn't it, I think?
It is.
Okay, so I think in terms of... We can talk more about Cagney and we'll come on to him, but I thought it's interesting that... I want to talk a bit about the narrative structure of this film. Mm-hmm. I'm saying that it's a relatively simplistic kind of narrative pattern. And yeah, I think that the classic thing you hear about these 1930s films, isn't it, is that they have this rise and fall structure that they kind of follow. So, you know, you see the rise of somebody like Tom Powers, and ultimately he's brought down. So it's kind of an interesting thing, isn't it? And that's one of the common threads between all those films you mentioned, Little Caesar, Public Enemy, Scarface, is that they're brought down by the end of the film. And obviously it's not a narrative, you know, that happens in other types of stories too, but it works very well in this kind of context, doesn't it? In the gangster film context, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and Tom's fall here, I know we're kind of jumping around, but that's an interesting one, isn't it? Because part of me feels like the film could have ended even a few scenes earlier, you know, with him coming out and dying in the street. Having said that, I do think that final scene works pretty well with his body being delivered to the house as well. What do you think?
You know, when I see something like this that's, you know, many decades old, I wonder what the original audiences would have thought at that time. I mean, we're used to seeing all kinds of things today, but yeah, you kind of, you know, when they get the phone call at home and Mike gets the phone call and he says, Tom's coming back, you know, he's coming soon. And I wonder if audiences really believe that, okay, he's going to come through the door. He's going to come walking through the door. Maybe he's beat up. And then we get that reveal at the end that's really pretty shocking. And I wonder how shocking it was to audiences at the time. But yeah, it still carries a lot of power.
I think so, because it gives it kind of a tragic dimension, doesn't it, I think? And that's kind of like the thing with these films, like Little Caesar, where Edward G. Robinson speaks in the third person, doesn't he? Mm-hmm. What is it, Mother of Mercy? Is this the end of Rico?
Right.
It's like they have this kind of larger-than-life dimension to them, which is really interesting. Yeah, I think the rise and fall, it's good because it allows us to kind of enjoy the rise, don't we? You know, we enjoy their kind of rebellious behaviour. And then the fall sees them kind of punished for it, which allows, you know, Hollywood to make these films, I suppose. So it's an interesting one. What about Cagney then? So, yeah, he's a fascinating star, of course. This is kind of his, you know, big rise to fame, I suppose, isn't it? He was never, you know, his career really takes off with The Public Enemy, it seems like to me.
It does. And he made actually 3 films before this, but this is really the one that launched his career.
Yeah.
The thing about Cagney is you watch him in any film, but especially a film like this, and he's such a commanding presence.
Yeah.
He's always in control of what he's doing. You can't take your eyes off of him. He's just amazing. And he does so many things in this film. I love this little short jab that he does with his fists. Oh, yeah. He does that a lot. And there's a scene where Tom shakes hands with a character. I forget who it is. And then he wrings his own hands as if he's trying to rid himself of some type of contamination. Maybe there's some early social distancing problems going on. I mean, he could do so much with his hands, his face. His eyes, I mean, he just breathes life into this character. And I think it's one of the things you mentioned about the rise and fall. He makes us care about him. And especially when the scenes with the family, I mean, because everybody's got family issues, right? Mm-hmm. So we can relate to that, and we can relate to maybe not the gangster activity, but we see that he's got it's not a broken family, but it's a fractured family. Things are not well in that house. And I think we can all relate to that, and we want things to be right between him and Mike and his mom. So when the end does happen, we really do feel for him because we've gotten to know him, we've gotten to love him. You know, he was such a great character. And we may talk about this too. I mean, Cagney was so talented. I mean, he was, mm-hmm. a lot of people know he was a tap dancer. Yeah. So there's so much fluidity in his movement. And so many different looks, that look at the end when it's raining is just a totally menacing look. It's really no wonder audiences responded to this role. He's just tremendous in it.
Yeah, it's all the things you say there, isn't it? And I think like his voice is also very important, isn't it? Because it's interesting in this film how he contrasts with some of the other actors, isn't it? Like the guy playing Putty Nose. I think I heard somewhere that, you know, in a lot of these early sound gangster films, they often favoured English actors, you know, who had this kind of clear way of enunciating a dialogue. But of course, with Cagney, you get this kind of rat-a-tat delivery, don't you?
Right.
And as well with people like Owen G. Robinson as well in other films. So people like those sound much more like what you imagine a film gangster to sound like, don't they? And I think that helps carry the film. Because like I said, in Little Caesar, for instance, I say it's quite a static film, but I think Robinson's performance is dynamic and it kind of carries it. And with Cagney, I don't know. Do you know what I mean? Like his vocal style and that just... I suppose the type of performance in general, but it's kind of a perfect fit when you think about this kind of urban environment that you find in the gangster films like Public Enemy. Does that make sense?
It does. And, you know, and one of the things too, Cagney had really lived the street life himself. He grew up in a very tough environment, and he had to learn how to handle a lot of bullies and a lot of street kids. So, you know, as part of that was somewhat second nature, I would imagine. I haven't read that much about Cagney, but I think a lot of it was just natural. I mean, he just knew how to carry that role off because he'd either seen other people do it or he grew up around it, or maybe it was just him.
I'd like to know the sort of full story on that and like how much of it was studio publicity and what the real story is. I'll have to read about him a bit more. I don't think I've read a full biography of Cagney. But yeah, it's really interesting.
Yeah.
And there's just so many great scenes, aren't there, to demonstrate just how watchable he was. Like you mentioned this, his movement, and that made me think of, you know, the moment when they drop off Gwen, Gene Harlow's character, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. and he pulls out this like little dance twirl or whatever it was. Just really good. But there's so many scenes, aren't there? Like the grapefruit scene, that's a famous one, isn't it? And like Yeah, what about the one where he, also, I really like the scene where he spits beer in the barman's face, jumps behind the bar, turns all the taps on, kind of manhandles the guy. You really get a sense, don't you, for stuff like that, how, I mean, it's aggression, but it's something very engaging about it too, if that makes sense.
No, I love that scene. And, you know, it caught me by surprise because I hadn't seen this movie in a while. Yeah. And, I was reading something and one article said that, you know, back in the early 30s, the film critics didn't go to the press screenings. They didn't have press screenings, but they sat with the audiences on the first day of a film's release. And when they watched Cagney's antics like that, the spitting the inferior beer back into the bartender's face, you know, the audiences were just loving it. They just roared and it was kind of like they were thinking, hey, you know, the gangsters get away with stuff like this. This must be a pretty sweet life.
Yeah, well, that's interesting. Yeah, because I think we could talk about Tom as an example. You mentioned Capone already, but it's really interesting how these kind of bootlegger characters, the racketeers, you know, and they're in a lot of these early films, these early gangster films. And Prohibition, of course, goes on till 1933, doesn't it? So it's still, you know, in place at this point. We mentioned these kind of historical scenes during the film, the 1909 sequences and so on. I also really like the one on Prohibition Eve, you know, mm-hmm. where it's almost like there's this kind of festival atmosphere, isn't there? You know, like the horns going off and, you know, just all this activity. I thought that was a lot of fun. But from my understanding, and you might be able to add to this, I don't know, but it'd been kind of a cultural shift because you mentioned like the Musketeers of Pig Alley as kind of a forerunner of the gangster film. And then during the 20s, I think there are things like Joseph von Sternberg made the film Underworld, which is really good. Mm-hmm. People are able to see that. But you see the shift, don't you, where gangsters start to be depicted as like sharply dressed, you know, the sharp suits, the hats and all that, you know, and the gangsters take on these modern business methods. And yeah, the cultural cultural reference point for that must be Al Capone, mustn't it? And like, to what extent do you sort of feel Capone's presence in The Public Enemy? Like, how direct do you think it is?
I think it's more direct in Little Caesar, because apparently that was, you know, directly taken from the life of Al Capone. But, you know, what's interesting is apparently from what I've read, The Public Enemy, Cagney's character of Tom was pretty much based on Chicago gangster named Earl Jaime Weiss, who was a rival of Al Capone. So there's a little bit of connection there. But yeah, you do bring up some really interesting points about the gangster lifestyle and, you know, the clothes, the money. We start to see this in films where, you know, we see it in Little Caesar, and we also see it here, that, you know, Cagney's wardrobe gets better. It's flashier. You know, he draws the attention of more attractive women. So there's that, you know, that underlying thought that, you know, if you could live this lifestyle, you could have all these things too. You know, that's been around forever. But, you know, in the gangster film, it really, really takes a deep hold.
Yeah, that's and it progresses, doesn't it? Like, he starts off with like the flat caps, and he moves to, you know, we actually see him visit the tailor, don't we?
Right, great scene.
Interesting scene. Yeah, it's an interesting scene because it's kind of the tailor's kind of effeminate, isn't it?
Right.
And I believe that scene was actually removed from the film later, you know, when it was re-released, and then subsequently was restored many decades later, thankfully, with a couple of other scenes, which we'll talk about. But yeah, no, it's a good point about, you know, Capone wasn't the only one, but he was the main one, is kind of what I was saying. And like, he'd been heavily in the press since the St. Valentine's Day Massacre, which was 1929. He was named Public Enemy number one in April 1930, I believe. So yeah, all these issues, what I'm saying, is very, very topical at this time, at the time the gangster film was really enjoying this great success. And it's just interesting, isn't it? Like, this idea that people like Tom Powers, they're like these kind of businessmen, you know? And like, I think that was something Capone had kind of talked about himself. You know, I think I've got a quote here from Capone. "I'm just a businessman. My rackets are run along strict American lines. This American system of ours, call it capitalism, call it what you like, gives each and every one of us a great opportunity if we only seize it with both hands and make the most of it. I've made my money by supplying a popular demand." So this idea that, like, the gangster's kind of an entrepreneur, and I think that's maybe what... Is that the kind of thing you're talking about when you say it appeals during the Depression, you know, when people are struggling for their, you know, for their livelihoods and so on?
Right, because I think audiences saw these guys as something of a success story, and maybe it didn't inspire them to go into crime, but it might have inspired them to be a little more, you know, inventive about how they're going to make a living in this Great Depression. One thing we didn't talk about is there's a, and it ties into this a little bit, there's the disclaimer at the very beginning of the film.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the fact that the gangsters got what was coming to them, and you know, there was even then there was like an outcry from a lot of audience members saying that, you know, this film glamorized violence and crime and gang activity. So, you know, it's almost like they're trying to cover their bases. Warner Brothers is, you know, this is a pretty code film. But they still have a disclaimer at the beginning that basically says, hey, audiences, don't glorify gangsters, or, you know, hey, kids, don't try this at home. You know, but, you know, Daryl Zanuck, he defended the movie, saying, you know, if we show this environment that makes crime possible, we're actually performing a public service. Yeah, that's it. Public service. Yeah.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I think I like those on-screen messages in the sense that they feel very much like a fig leaf, you know, and like, in other words, like, if that's the price that has to be paid for the rest of the film to not really be full of moralizing, then, you know, that's a price I'll happily pay. I'll sit through these messages, that's fine. But like, The Public Enemy is quite interesting in that sense, isn't it? Because there is some interesting complexity at play though, isn't there? Like, Tom's brother Mike disapproves of what Tom gets up to. But Tom kind of comes back at him with a fairly valid argument. It seems, well, we don't know, but he comes back at him forcefully, doesn't he? You know, your hands ain't so clean. All that kind of stuff. And it seems like Mike, because he goes to war, of course, and then comes back, but it seems like he's very much damaged by doing the right thing, quote unquote, doesn't it? Like, I don't know. I guess they were kind of suggesting what we'd think of today as kind of PTSD, but I don't know. Is that how you kind of took it?
I did, and I kind of thought it was fascinating, and I was thinking about it, and, you know, they do have some of these great exchanges, the sibling rivalry that really goes beyond normal sibling rivalry. And especially the scene where Mike won't take Tom's beer or blood money, he calls it. And like you said, Tom says to him, "Your hands aren't clean. You killed and you liked it." And I think the thing that's amazing about this is, you know, Mike is a war hero or a veteran, and he's not taking any risks in life anymore. It's like he's already done that on the battlefield. And Tom, between the two of them, Tom is the one that's really alive. He is taking risks. He is living life to the fullest. You know, he's going to have to pay a price for it. But Mike is not taking any risks anymore. So, you know, I wonder again how audiences felt, like, you know, here's a veteran that's coming home that's really playing everything safe. Maybe he deserves that because of what, you know, his sacrifice in the war. And then here's Tom that's just alive and kicking and just taking every risk imaginable.
Yeah, I think that's one of the very interesting implications of gangster narrative, isn't it? It's like, if you really want an exciting life, you know, if you really want that, you've got to do these things. You've got to live in this world. You know, it's kind of interesting to me. Mm-hmm. I think you mentioned violence there earlier, and that's an interesting idea, I think. It's an interesting aspect of the film. What do you make of that? Because it's quite a brutal film in some respects, but then it's kind of discreet in others, isn't it? It's kind of interesting the way Wellman presents the violence, I think.
I think it is. And like you said, there's kind of the trade-off. There's a significant amount of violence that takes place off the screen. Putty Nose's death. We hear it, but the camera moves away from him and the piano as the actual shooting happens. Also the shooting of the horse. We hear it, but we don't see it. And obviously what happens to Tom right before his final appearance at the end, we don't actually see that happening. But, you know, there's plenty of other things like the big shootout near the end where they're, you know, the concrete is just blown away. And apparently those were real bullets that they were using.
Oh, is that right?
There. I can't find anything that says that they weren't. And there is a good bit of violence here. And we and again, you know, that brings up a topic of, you know, what audience would have considered violence then and what we consider violence now. I mean, today, this film, on a grand scheme of everything that we see, is not that violent. But, you know, for that time, I think there were a lot of things that were really, really edgy. I mean, even and we haven't really talked too much about the grapefruit scene. You know, that really delivered some shock value in 1931. I mean, we look at it today and, you know, you see more violence in a Three Stooges sketch, but that was pretty shocking for the time. So you're right. So we've got violence and kind of the suppression of or the non-disclosure of violence here.
Yeah, I think the grapefruit scene, I think it's the sneer on Cagney's face is what kind of makes it. I think it's just a very interesting performer. The things he does, you know, it's kind of hard to kind of pin down. But yeah, I was thinking about. Well, we're talking about the links with business and capitalism and so on. And I think there's an interesting scene here where Putty Nose gives Tom and Matt the pistols and he says it's a Christmas present from Santa Claus. Mm. And that's kind of an interesting comment to me. It's like these links with capitalism are associated with this violent, you know, instrument, you know. But yeah, I like the way Wellman does it. You know, I like the shooting of Putty Nose, the way the camera turns away. The horse, it really interests me. I'm like, I don't find animal cruelty funny, but just the idea that the guy's thought it was imperative that they shoot a horse kind of, it's funny to me. No, you're right. I think it's gangster films generally are very violent and it's always dictated by what you can get away with at that point in time, isn't it? I think I talked about this a bit with Tony, with Bonnie and Clyde, where that was a shocking, you know, movie at that time.
Yeah.
And today I don't think people would be shocked by it necessarily, but that was kind of cutting edge. And I think with The Public Enemy, you get a good sense of, like, less is more at times, don't you? Like, that scene where Tom Powers is stood outside in the rain, you know, towards the end of the film. I don't know if you agree, but it's, like, almost like seeing the look on his face tells you everything you need to know. You don't need to see what happens inside that building.
Yeah, it does. And, you know, we've seen, up until that point, we've seen a lot of different looks from Cagney. But I think that scene in the rain, and that's the first time we've seen him looking that menacing. I mean, that is really frightening.
Yeah. Okay. Let's talk a bit more. I thought it'd be interesting to talk about sort of the big outcry these films generated. So I pulled up some fun quotes and things. And it's not just this film, of course, and it ties in very much with things like Little Caesar that we've talked about. Yeah, what's your sense of the broadly the kind of debates around such films as The Public Enemy? Like, how do you think this played out in like the public sphere, as it were?
I looked and I saw some different views from critics at the time. There was a quote in Variety that said, "There's no lace on this picture. It's raw and brutal. It's lowbrow material given highbrow treatment." And apparently it was a huge hit, and yeah. People went to see it not once or twice, but several times. You know, I think Tom Powers was probably the toughest character most audiences at that time had ever seen before.
Yeah, I was going to, I've been reading one of the books, I covered it on the podcast actually, Forbidden Hollywood by Mark A. Vieira, which is all about the pre-code era. Really good book. And he talks about Little Caesar and the Public Enemy, and there's some really fascinating details in there. So I'll just cover Little Caesar briefly because it kind of ties in, of course. But he talked about how that was like a massive commercial sensation. You know, over 3,000 people turned up for the film's opening in New York. And he says that the pressure of those, you know, their bodies broke the glass doors of the Strand Theatre at Broadway on 47th Street. And then you get all these disapproving reactions. So again, this is Little Caesar, not Public Enemy, but it's interesting. There was a guy called Dr. James Wingate, and now he's an interesting figure. He was the head of the motion picture division of the State of New York Education Department. Apparently his censorship decisions were influential. And, you know, just the idea that children could see this guy run, you know, living his life of luxury and form the idea, the child could form the idea that they could do the same and get away with it. So he insisted that that film was cut in New York. Mm-hmm. Now, with The Public Enemy, Wingate was less concerned about the film. He felt that the story deserved to be told, although he had some reservations about the weakness of the police. Mm. And that's kind of interesting, isn't it? It's interesting to me that in a film like this, to make that rise and fall structure work, the gangster has to be very successful, but by extension, you're kind of saying that the police aren't up to much, if that makes sense. Right. Do you know what I mean? Like, the kind of implication, anyway. At the same time, apparently, Will Hayes, he said that the American public's beginning to vote thumbs down on this kind of thing. But he was wrong, because The Public Enemy did even better at the box office than Little Caesar. So what do you make of, like, the general idea is that, you know, and it extends beyond the 1930s films, I think, but the idea that depicting gangsters on screen can easily tip over into being too sympathetic and it becomes kind of immoral. Like, what do you think about the whole kind of idea?
You know, that's a great question that, you know, we're still dealing with. You know, people are still up in arms. Some people are about what is shown on screen. Of course, things are different now because you can stream things, and it's not the same atmosphere exactly. But yeah, it's the thing about a movie is, as you and I both know, it's all about selling tickets. It's all economic. So you want to get people into the theaters, and to do that, you have to figure out what audiences really want to see. And when you have something like The Public Enemy, Little Caesar, you've got these really bad guys who are really the heroes of the film. We know, especially in this era, we know that they're going to have to pay for their crimes at the end of the movie. Yeah. But it's still so much fun watching them rise to the top. I don't know. There's just something about us that we want to see. Maybe part of it is we know that they're going to be punished and we want to see that. But there's something, I hate to say inspiring, but there's something about these characters that we want to imitate in some way. Maybe it's their courage. It's their, it's something. I mean, you think about, I'm sure you did too. I mean, when we were kids and we would see movies about, like Bonnie and Clyde or gangsters, mm-hmm. we would go home and imitate those scenes. I mean, these were really, I don't know if you would say heroes, but there was something about them that we wanted to embrace ourselves. Either it was their confidence, their swagger. And I think audiences responded to that then, and they still do.
Yeah, I think when I was a kid, I had like a little potato gun. You know, I don't know if they still have those these days, but you'd kind of take the potato chippings and make them your bullets. But I think I was more inspired by cowboys and gangsters. That's good, I've got to say. But yeah, no, this idea that they caused this moral panic is interesting. And in that book I mentioned, the Mark A. Vieira book, he includes like some letters to Will Hayes and some comments, public comments and things. So I'll read you one, which is kind of emblematic, I think. "These gang pictures, that's terrible kid stuff. They're doing nothing but harm to the younger element of the country. I don't blame the censors for trying to bar them. And the interesting thing about that comment is that that was actually made by Al Capone.
he kind of, wow.
He actually weighed in on the debate, which is kind of, that's kind of a brass neck, I think.
Yeah.
In terms of the general debate you were just talking about there, and I think it's very interesting what you're saying. I mean, personally, I'm always in favour of treating the audience like adults, you know, like we're not just passive receptacles, I don't think. We can decide what we want to see. We can make our own minds up about what we do see. But yeah, I think it goes back again. That rise and fall structure is very important. It means that some semblance of law and order can be suggested at the end. So to be honest, I don't think these films would work anywhere near as well, though, if they downplayed like the glamorous aspects of the lifestyle. You know, I think you need to understand the appeal of this kind of behaviour. You need to understand why someone like Tom Powers wants to climb the ladder. I don't know. I think the thing is that when I think of gangster films, the people I think of are like these larger-than-life characters. You know, people like James Cagney or Edward G. Robinson or Al Pacino or Robert De Niro. They're not really actors who come across like normal people to me. Certainly not in their gangster films. Do you know what I mean? I think we watch them in a state of fascination.
Yeah.
I've never watched a Cagney film and thought, hey, that guy's just like me. I could never be like Cagney no matter how hard I try. Do you know what I mean? There's kind of a fascination to it, if that's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, but I think there's though elements in those Cagney films that we might say, you know, I don't act that way, or I don't have his personality, but I wish I had his confidence, or I wish I had his courage, things like that. I think we see those things and think, you know, I wish I had that element of him. I'm not going to go out and be a gangster, but I wish I had the confidence that he has.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And obviously he enjoys the fruits of that success and so on, like we talked about. So yeah, that's true. And part of that, playing into that idea are some of the women in this film, who I think we should talk about. And I think there are some interesting women in this film, actually. I mean, you possibly wouldn't necessarily think about the gangster film always as a great vehicle for roles for women. But I mean, in this one, you've got people like Mae Clark, Joan Blondell, and of course, Jean Harlow, who's interesting. I think Gwen, Carlo's character, she's kind of a good example of a gangster's moll, isn't she? And that, I suppose that becomes kind of a stock character. But I think she's an interesting example of it.
I think she's interesting, too. It's really unusual that she is in this film. Actually, there are people... I did some reading online that were not kind to Harlow's performance in this film. Yeah. It's almost like she's from another world. She doesn't talk like everybody else. In fact, one of the critics said that, you know, Ms. Harlow, you really need to learn how to talk like everyone else in the film if you want to have any kind of career at all. But, you know, she does seem, you know, there's something about her voice that just doesn't, I mean, she's visually interesting, obviously, but you know, there's just something about her voice sounds untrained and the others sound more like that. But she definitely gets your attention, you know, because she's Jean Harlow. But yeah, there is, I think the critics were onto something. There's something about her that doesn't quite gel in this movie. I don't think it's the best fit for her, but I'm glad she's in it.
Yeah. Well, it's very strange, like, delivery from her, isn't it? Like, I think there was one line in particular I noted where she says, "You don't care, do you?" You know, it's like a really stilted delivery. I think that's part of it. That's a large part of it, I think. But yeah, no, I think the moles are interesting because they tie back into that idea that, you know, the gangster's success is conveyed in various ways. Like, he treats his moles well because it's kind of showing her off to the other gangsters, you know. And they don't do much in narrative terms for the most part, but they often make an impression, you know, whether for whatever reason. Sometimes they have these memorable kind of wisecracks, you know. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a contrast, isn't it, with the people who kind of marry into or who are blood family, you know, like the wives and the mothers. Like, because we've got Ma here. And she's just kind of presented as like an ineffectual figure, isn't she? And it seems like you get a lot of characters like that in gangster films too, you know, like kind of weak mother kind of figure. And I suppose it plays back into what you were saying about the importance of family in the gangster film. Because Tom's father's out of the picture early on here, isn't he?
Yeah, we don't really see him when they're adults. Just the last time we see him is when he's beating Tom. But yeah, that's a good point about the women characters really in all gangster films. They seem to, you know, take a subordinate role, and we don't spend as much time with them. It's almost like they're waiting until the gangster comes back so they can, you know, have something semblance of a normal life. Now the malls are a little bit different. You know, sometimes you can have a gangster that's married and has a yeah. girlfriend, but there are, you know, the you're right about the roles being pretty small. I mean, even Mae Clark has a pretty small role yeah. in this film. I mean, she had much bigger roles in films like Frankenstein, Front Page, but it's interesting that she's mainly remembered for this and not those other films. But that is an interesting thing that you don't – typically the women characters in gangster films are not as developed as the gangsters themselves. That's true, yeah. Unfortunately. Yeah.
I think it gets better over time. It takes a while, though. I think eventually you get things like Married to the Mob with Michelle mm-hmm. Pfeiffer, and I think like Goodfellas has got a really good part for Lorraine Bracco, and The Sopranos has got really interesting women, yeah, things like that. Yeah. But it takes a long time, doesn't it? It takes a while for that to become more typical, I think, yeah. Yeah, so we've kind of been talking about this as a pre-code film and so on, and so it comes at a really interesting historical juncture, doesn't it? And I don't know if everybody listening like knows the ins and outs of the code and when it came in and when it started to be applied forcefully and so on. So like, how would you kind of explain that to people? Like, this is when the code existed but was not enforced, wasn't it? So they had a bit more leeway, but that was soon to change, fairly soon to change.
Yeah, and I'm not really an expert on the code, but 1934 is when it really came into being enforced.
Yeah.
The studios could, you know, they pretty much had a choice. You can either have congressional control over this, or if you police yourselves, you know, if you can prove to us that you're going to be able to police yourselves and keep any inappropriate content off the screen, we're going to let you do it. And basically that's what happened. The studios were themselves responsible for making sure that, you know, you could not show crime paying. You couldn't show policemen in a, you couldn't show corrupt policemen. Obviously you couldn't show sexuality. You couldn't show, extreme violence, things like that. So, you know, the code was in place, and this is a pre-code movie. And that's an interesting thing to ponder. You know, what about this film would have been different had it been released in 1934, 1935? And I think we've already mentioned that, you know, some of those scenes were cut for yep. a re-release. So you can definitely look at movies that were after the code or, 1934 and beyond, and then go back and watch this and think, wow, you know, that wouldn't have made the cut, literally. That's a whole fascinating study is looking at pre-code movies and determining, you know, what was allowed, what wasn't allowed. But yeah, I wish I knew more about that. I could talk more, at length on it.
I've got a little bit more I've kind of pulled up over the last few days. But yeah, I think that's really well said. And I think what probably would have happened is if this, you know, the role of the police would have had to have been much more prominent if this film was just a few years later. Of course, gangster films carry on. You sort of get the development of the outlaw film, which are often become like a Cops v. Robbers kind of thing afterwards. You get things like Comic Gangsters, you know, you get various offshoots. And then, of course, you're getting further and further away from Prohibition. So the historical kind of context becomes more nostalgic. So yeah, I think part of the pressure that led to the code being enforced, there had been these studies carried out in the late 20s, early 30s that were kind of investigating the connection between on-screen criminality and youth offending. And what they found was a lot of these young men they talked to were really approved of gangster films. I got a quote here. There was a guy, a young man who was serving a burglary sentence. He said that watching gangster films gave him the desire to always have plenty of money and ride around in swell machines, wear good clothes, and grab a girl whenever you wanted. I still think it would be a great life. So it kind of plays into exactly what we've been talking about. Yeah. And there was a youngster from Chicago who said, seeing gangsters having lots of money and big cars and being big shots makes a fellow want them. So yeah, that kind of idea. And also the idea that you could learn how to do things like open safes by watching gangster films.
Right.
You know, how to one of the examples a report quoted was you could watch gangster films and learn how to carry a machine gun in a violin case. You know, that idea.
Right.
That it was teaching you how to be bad. And of course, yeah, the Production Code Administration formed in 1934 and in place until 68, but kind of weakened by the end, you know.
Yeah.
Because of course Bonnie and Clyde is 67, but the code, like I say, had weakened by that point. But yeah, so the scenes that were cut from the film, now this upsets me. So what happened was, once the production code administration was introduced, if the studios wanted to re-release a film, Joe Breen of the PCA made them cut scenes from the original negatives. So films that were cut in this way include The Public Enemy, also, you know, great films like All Quiet on the Western Front, or Frankenstein. The scenes that were taken out here, that scene where Cagney's being measured for a suit, like I said, that one, a shot of Joan Blondell serving Eddie Wood's breakfast in bed, because it suggested that they'd spent the night together. And the scene, I'm not sure if this is the full scene or part of it, but where Cagney's gets drunk and is unwittingly seduced by, I think her name's Jane, isn't it? The other gangster's girlfriend, yeah. So it's just a good thing that those were ultimately restored for the DVD release, I think. But it's still kind of upsetting to think about, I don't know, is it too strong to call that kind of vandalism, you know, cutting out scenes from a film in that way?
Yeah, I always hate to see that. I mean, I want to see the original, you know, what the directors and the producers' original intent was on the screen. Yeah, that's always disturbing to me. And you know, we're adults too, and we're, you know, the time is different. I doubt there's anything in any of these films that's going to just, you know, absolutely shock any adult that's been watching movies for, you know, 20, 30, 40 years. But yeah, you don't want to have this stuff tampered with, and especially something that, you know, this was pre-code, as we mentioned, that I wish it could have been left intact so that when it was re-released, audiences could have seen it as it was. But yeah, they just, it was just the time, you know, and that happened a lot, I imagine. I don't really know how many films were re-released regularly that they had to do that with, but I know this was definitely one of them.
Yeah, and I think there was just kind of a different attitude to the art form, wasn't there? Like, you know, whether a film even was an art form. So I think people who didn't think it was necessarily, or didn't approach it in that way, just a bit more cavalier, we're kind of hacking stuff up, and it's very sad to me. But I think it's a good thing that this film in particular we can see properly, and the DVD release is really good. Andy, was there anything else about the film? We've talked about a lot of the big issues. Was there anything that we've kind of overlooked you wanted to mention?
No, I think we did a really good job. I do want to give another shout to William Wellman for making such a great film, and of course he goes far back into the silent era. But there's so many things that we see now that we would take for granted that were pretty innovative then, especially the like the sound of the coal truck before the shootout. We hear that sound and it sounds like violent, maybe gunshots, and it's not. And then, you know, we do get the gunshot. So it's shot. So it's something of a tip off for the upcoming mayhem. But he does a lot of really interesting camera shots too. There's a shot where the car is driving out of, I'm not sure exactly where it is, but we see it from underneath.
Oh yeah.
That's the first time I've ever seen that shot in a film that early. And, you know, understandably, I haven't seen a lot of silent films. So, but you know, he Wellman's taking a lot of chances here. He's mixing it up, and, I don't think he gets the credit he deserves, not only for this film, but a lot of films that he did, even going back to probably the first one that most people would know about would be Wings from 1927, the Oscar winner. So I think he's a director that really merits more attention.
Do you think some of that, though, is because you could look at a film like this and maybe instead of thinking William Wellman, you might be more primed to think Warner Brothers, if that makes sense, because it very much kind of fits their kind of house style, doesn't it? So do you think maybe that's why he's got more of an anonymous kind of stature, perhaps?
It could be, and I think it definitely is that. I mean, it definitely fits into the Warner Brothers style, which was still really developing at this time, because sound was still, you know, fairly new. But yeah, I think that's a good, you know, he was just one of a lot of directors that worked at Warner Brothers. But you know, I still think I think he should be singled out and should be explored more. In fact, I have a recommendation in a few minutes that's one of his earlier films.
Ah, nice, nice. I was going to, in terms of recommendations, I was going to ask you if you've any gangster film books or anything that you would recommend to people, or maybe books about the Public Enemy specifically. I'm not sure if there are any, but yeah, what should people read if they kind of had their interest piqued by the things we've talked about here?
Well, again, I'm not excuse me, I had to grab a book. I'm not that much of an authority on the gangster film, but there is a book I came across not too long ago called The Gangster Film Reader, edited by Alan Silver and James Orsini. Those guys also do a lot of writing about film noir. So that's a really interesting book that covers a lot of different films, and I would recommend that one. But I, other than that, I've just mainly just perused mostly articles.
Okay, I haven't come across that book, so that sounds fascinating. I can recommend a couple, though. There's a really good book called Dreams and Dead Ends by a guy called Jack Chedoyan, all about the history of the gangster film. It's very analytical, very good analysis. He analyzes a couple of films at length from each sort of era. So he analyzes The Public Enemy and Little Caesar, and then goes through the decades, you know, the up to The Godfather and beyond, up to the 1990s, I think. So that's a good one, I think. I'm not sure if it's still in print and stuff like that. I've got an old secondhand copy, I think. There's also a book published more recently called The Gangster Film, Fatal Success in American Cinema by a guy called Ron Wilson, and that's a shorter read. But that gives you a lot of the historical context and so on. So I think that's a good book. The Wilson book is good. We talked about how, you know, we're not saying, neither of us are saying that this, The Public Enemy, is the start of the gangster film. He talks about the historical development of it. And there are some films, you can go on YouTube, you can find films from like 1906 that are like films about criminal gangs. Mm. I think there's one called The Silver Wedding, and very different because they're very much about street crime. It's different. The kind of thing we're talking about here is when they get to be, you know, bootleggers and so on. But it's kind of interesting to watch that develop. Mm. And we mentioned The Musketeers of Pig Alley and things like Underworld. So yeah, there's lots of stuff out there in the silent era that's worth people's time as well, I think. What were you saying there about the Wellman recommendation, Andy? There was something else you wanted to point people towards, is that right?
Yeah, actually, this was a movie that I thought came out a little bit earlier, but actually it came out the same year as The Public Enemy, and this is a William Wellman movie called Safe in Hell, which I think people should check out. It's a little bit different slant on the gangster film. It has Dorothy McHale plays a prostitute who unintentionally kills one of her clients and hides out on this tropical island that's something of a hideout for criminals. It's a really, really interesting movie because it's not a typical gangster film, but it has some of those same tropes that you would see, and with a woman lead, which we mentioned a little bit last time.
Yeah, I think from what I've read, there are a few like interesting little gangster films with women leads. Like there's a film called Lady Scarface. I haven't seen it. It sounds really interesting.
I haven't seen it either. I'd like to.
Yeah. I think my recommendation to people would just be, and to reiterate what we've both said really, but this idea that the classic phase of the gangster film is really this 1930 to 1932. And I believe there are over almost 100 gangster films in that period. The ones people always point towards are The Public Enemy, Little Caesar, and Scarface. Mm-hmm. The Howard Hawks Scarface, of course. And I guess that's a timely rewatch because they've just announced a new remake of Scarface, haven't they? I don't know if you saw that, Andy.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know when that's going to come out, but that'll be fascinating, I think. All right, Andy, I guess we could leave it there. So, what are you up to on social media or on your website these days? Where can people find you?
Sure, you can find me. My website is andywolverton.com. I have a blog there, which I contribute to usually at least once or twice a week. I'll have something up there, a movie review or just talking about movies in general. And you can also find me on Letterboxd, A. Wolverton. And then you can find me on Twitter at awolverton77.
Great stuff. And as we said at the as you mentioned at the outset, you're doing these online film discussions, and we're recording just a couple of days before the episode comes out. So, yeah, what exactly have you got coming up that people might want to check out? Yeah,
let me see if I can find that. I want to make sure that I give you the right thing. Yeah. I know that we've got coming up this week. We're going to do the Lavender Hill Mob.
Ooh.
With Alec Guinness.
Yeah.
And in the future, we've got films by Kiarostami. We're going to do The Wind Will Carry Us.
Yeah.
We're also doing one of my favorite films that may not be a great film for this time because it's so dark is Seconds by John Frankenheimer, starring Rock Hudson. So that looking forward to that. I'm trying to mix it up with some lighter stuff, with some heavy, like, you know, Lavender Hill Mob is pretty light. And then we're going to do The Wages of Fear later on. Leon Morin Priest. So there's a lot of variety in there. We, you know, when we first did this, the people in charge of the library said, you know, you really need to keep it light. We want to do just, you know, light, feel good movies. And we did for a while. And then the audiences were like, you know, I think we're ready for the harder stuff. We can handle it.
What have you ever screened The Public Enemy or something like that? That would be a fun kind of experiment, wouldn't it? To see what people made of that these days, you know?
You know, I haven't. And actually, I had not really a gangster film, but I had chosen to show. Actually, it was going to be next month, but we won't be able to show anything publicly for a while. Is Babyface, Barbara Stanwyck. Haven't done too much from the 30s. We've done some Marx Brothers and maybe one or two others from the 30s. A good bit of film noir, though. If you know me, that's no big surprise.
Great stuff, Andy. Thanks for that. Really enjoyed talking, as ever. Hope it's not too long until we podcast again.
Yeah, well, thanks again, Carl, for having me.
Yeah, no worries. My pleasure. Just as I said at the outset, listeners, so Bonnie and Clyde is our next episode. That's a crossover with a new podcast, The New Wave. That will be coming to you next week, and that is more... I'm kind of in the guest role for that one, but it'll be a lot of fun to bring that one to you. I think that one will go out on... It will go out midweek instead of at the beginning of the week, as I normally aim for. But yeah, that'll be coming soon. In the meantime, you can find The Movie Palace in all the usual places, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, at Movie Palace Pod on Twitter. That's all for today, listeners, but I hope you can join me next time when the curtain rises once again at The Movie Palace.
Previously on the We Made This Network. The X-Cast, an X-Files podcast.
And just as a side note, right at that moment when they come off of the elevator, they seem to be surrounded by a lot of children. And I don't know, do you know, what is this building that they're in?
Well, it wasn't the federal, or was it the federal building?
I don't think so.
No, but it did have some federal offices. So, yeah, I don't know why the children would be there, although it looked like sort of a school trip, was it?
Yeah, that's what I thought. I thought, well, they must be on a field trip.
Yeah.
It's probably the middle of the day, you know?
Right.
What are they doing there? But what, like, are they touring the tiny FEMA office that we find out about later? And, like, why would they let the children in with the alien infected bodies in the FEMA office?
Right.
Like, I don't know.
Yeah.
I always wonder, what are those kids doing there?
Without a mouse.
You've got some news, haven't you, Tim?
News or lack of news or anti-news, but if you couldn't guess already, the Disney trip that I was supposed to be going on and have been going on about since the very beginning of this fucking podcast did not happen.
Tim, I felt so sorry for you. And particularly when I was listening back to the most recent episodes that you recorded pre-coronavirus, but you aired them during coronavirus. It was just, it was so sad, and I was like,
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, I can't give you a hug. One, because you live a million miles away, and two, because I can't go there anyway.
Cinemortuary.
I don't know who Steven Spielberg was trying to kid, but he clearly directed this, not the other guy.
Oh, cool, mate. You've trumped my joke now. I was going to try and clean my glasses lenses and say, can anybody see W?
It's quite clearly him as directing it. And all the worst traits about Steven Spielberg come out here, especially the fucking irritating kids.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network.